At Epic Burger, every classic burger is made with 100% natural, halal-certified Angus beef. Epic Burger uses real, premium-quality ingredients in their mission to serve a more mindful burger to every customer. There are 8 Epic Burger locations around Chicagoland. Grab a friend and head to Epic Burger to try the halal-friendly burger today. This is a rebroadcasted episode. Catch us on all social media at Radio Islam USA.
Assalamu alaikum, peace and blessings upon you. Good evening and thank you for tuning in to Radio Islam at WCEV 1450 AM Chicago. I'm your host, Salahuddin Khan. We're a live call-in talk radio program airing every day from 6 to 7 p.m. Central, and we reach the world by streaming live at radioislam.com, where you can tap into all of our prior shows as well. To add to tonight's conversation, call us at 312-263-4752 or post on our Facebook page at facebook.com/radioislam1450 or tweet us at radioislam1450. Well, with all that's been going on recently, and actually it's sort of featured in the election in terms of what this country's attitude, as well as other countries, particularly Europe, should be towards migrants, one individual who's our next guest, our first guest this evening, has got a fairly radical view about migration insofar as it may be a basic human right. I think that's a correct representation of his thesis. And he's Alex Tabarak, and he's the Barclay J. Madden Chair in Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He's also a professor of economics at George Mason. He specializes in patent system reform, the effectiveness of bounty hunters compared to the police, how judicial elections bias judges, and how local poverty rates impact trial decisions by juries. Dr. Tabarak is also the co-author with a fellow colleague from Mercatus, Tyler Cohen, of the popular economics blog Marginal Revolution and co-founder of the online educational platform Marginal Revolution University. Welcome, Alex.
Great to be here.
And it's nice to have you, and thank you very much for joining us. So you pose a question which is intriguing, and that is migration a basic human right? And I think in there, if I have intoned the question correctly, it suggests that you may think that it is.
Absolutely. Okay. So I think if we think about what sort of world ultimately would we like to live on, it's a world where people can move about where they please. You know, why should we have these barriers, these walls and barbed wire and machine guns preventing people who are peaceful, who are moving voluntarily, preventing people from moving about the world?
Well, it sounds like a reasonable proposition. Help me to understand. Okay, there are examples. Let me put it out that way. You could argue, for example, that as organizations, the states in the United States operate in something like this fashion. So when you want to get from Illinois to, say, Indiana or Massachusetts, you don't have to confront a whole lot of issues or barriers in doing that. And similarly, especially with Schengen, in Europe, something analogous to this has also happened. What's wrong with those kinds of constructs?
Oh, nothing is wrong with them at all. I think that it provides the way forward. So I would like to see those constructs expanded. So as you point out, throughout Europe, people can move now from Germany to France, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. It's really one of the great achievements of the second half of the 20th century, that this continent, which had been so involved in wars and religious disputes for hundreds of years, that now people are free to move about Europe. And the same thing, of course, is true within the United States. So what I'd like to say is, well, how about letting people from Europe move to the United States and people from the United States move to Europe? And let's expand these areas further and further until the whole world is one free common market where people are free to move about.
It's certainly a fair point. The question then arises, I guess the people on the opposite side of this argument will raise issues of, let's say, economic opportunity, for example, or imbalances of populations as a result of such freedom. I want to take it from the other point of view, which is invasion. If you think about what an invasion is, aside from, you know, one group of people maybe overcoming another, there is also the government or the system of rule that is potentially up for change. How do you draw the distinction between what constitutes free movement and what constitutes, let's say, an invasion?
Well, I think nonviolent movement, just the willingness, most of the people who want to come, let's say, to the United States or to another developed country, they want to come to engage in trade and mm-hmm. peaceful, voluntary action. Now, it is true, people have fears. People generally fear foreigners for all kinds of reasons. They're bringing a different culture, they're bringing a different religion, they fear foreigners, or they're coming to take our jobs. I would say two things to this. First of all, there's what I call the Texas cheerleader mom example, and that is, let's suppose, think about the mom of the Texas cheerleader. Well, even though she wants her daughter to win the cheerleading competition, we think that it would be wrong for that mom to go and put spikes in the tire of her daughter's competition, right? Or to chain up her daughter's competition to prevent that person from competing with her daughter in the Texas cheerleader competition. So why, if that would be wrong, why is it okay to put up walls, to put up machine guns, to prevent people from coming here to compete for jobs? I don't see any difference between those two things.
Well, I guess, and again, I'm not necessarily taking one position or another. I can see both sides of the argument. But, one counter to that might be, well, you know, in a managed, bordered society, we have some measures of control. Like, for example, the EU has relatively free movement of goods and services within itself. But as you cross the line from outside of the EU into the EU, there are some protections of some sort. Notwithstanding globalization and the World Trade Organization, but nonetheless, those are intended, I think, to protect local interests. Local being defined within the boundaries of that admittedly enlarged institution. And similarly, in the U.S., you have tariffs of one kind or another. Isn't that commonly accepted as a reasonable premise? So that, for example, jobs and salaries get protected in that way, to a degree, at least.
Oh, it's certainly commonly accepted. I just think that it's wrong. I don't see any difference. These boundaries which we have mm-hmm. are really artificial boundaries. And, you know, human rights don't stop at the border. So if it's wrong to prevent a fellow citizen for competing from your job, why is it suddenly okay to prevent someone from competing for your job just because they were born in another country?
Well, I don't think it would be that they were born there, because there's plenty of people in this country that were not born in this country, myself being an example.
Because they live in another country.
Exactly.
They had to be born there.
They're
right?
naturalized in some other country. I wasn't born in the UK, of which I am a citizen.
But discrimination, mm-hmm. it's odd that we say that it's wrong to discriminate against somebody born in another country if they become an American, but it's okay if they're still living in that other country.
Yeah, and I certainly can accept that idea. But then come back to, large-scale movements of one kind or another that people, I think, generally are afraid of also. And In semblance, it might feel like an invasion. It doesn't necessarily happen all that much, because I think the evidence is to the contrary. I agree with the point. I think I remember reading that Romania, for example, has a fraction of the income level of, say, Sweden, and yet people who go there don't, from Romania to Sweden are not going in droves, and if they're going at all, many of them are coming back. So I can see the justification for the argument that says, well, it's not all going to displace everybody with ultra-cheap labor.
Right, and there's another point to raise, and that is that, today, capital moves about the world so easily at lightning speed. Mm-hmm. Goods, as you pointed out, move across the world. The only thing which is forbidden from moving is people. And it's people who have the most rights to move, not the least rights to move. Moreover, there's an economic aspect to this as well. And that is, there's a huge amount of economic gain. Because when people in a poor country, when people in a poor country move to a country like the United States or England or something like that, another developed country, their wages, as we well know, go way up, mm-hmm. double, triple, sometimes increase by 10 times, 5 times, 10 times,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that means that there's a huge amount of economic value to be gained there. If just moving a person from where their wages, from where their labor has low value to where their labor has high value can create a whole bunch of economic value. In fact, economists have calculated that if we let people move about, world GDP, that is, world GDP, not just today, but forevermore, would double. So that's a huge increase in wealth.
And it's probably true to say that this is, hasn't been shown to be a better method of attacking poverty than migration. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. So, for example, if we in the developed world were to allow 1%, an increase of 1% in our labor force coming from the less developed world, that would be worth more to the migrants than all of the world's official foreign aid combined.
And I know that a lot of people, I would say probably leaning more on the right than the left in this country, seem to single out foreign aid as one of the most despicable things that we do.
Yes, people are massively confused. They think that it's a huge part of the budget.
It's absolutely tiny. It's almost invisible.
Yeah. Exactly. Correct.
Have there been times in the history of the world where this notion of migration as a fundamental human right has existed and something that maybe we lost as a result of more rigorously defined nation states?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, the whole idea of passports is a relatively recent invention. And going back most definitely to the 19th century United States, we essentially had open borders in the United States for, you know, well over 100 years, including, people are always surprised to find this out, but we had an open border treaty with China, allowing anybody from China to come into the United States. And, you know, that eventually was overturned because of racism against Chinese workers. But for many years, we had a treaty saying that anybody from China could come to the United States and anybody from the United States could go to China.
Well, and that's an intriguing point. So I'm going to come back to what prompted some of these changes, if I may. But we're going to take a quick break.
Sure.
Stay with us, please, after the break on Radio Islam. We'll continue this fascinating conversation with Alex Tabarak about migration being a fundamental human right. There's still time to share your thoughts and questions on our program, so please remember, call in at 312-263-4752.
At Epic Burger, every classic burger is made with 100% natural, halal-certified Angus beef. Epic Burger uses real premium quality ingredients in their mission to serve a more mindful burger to every customer. There are 8 Epic Burger locations around Chicagoland. Grab a friend and head to Epic Burger to try the halal-friendly burger today.
Radio Islam, the nation's first daily live call-in talk radio show produced by Muslims for the mainstream market. Radio Islam, on the air since 2004 because of your generosity. Radio Islam salutes its most valuable asset, you, our listener. From our producers to our interns, we appreciate your support. Thank you.
This is a rebroadcasted episode. Catch us on all social media at Radio Islam USA.
Welcome back. You're listening to Radio Islam at WCEV 1450 AM Chicago. We reach the world by streaming live at radioislam.com. where you can also review all of our prior shows. Radio Islam is a live call-in talk show on the air every night from 6 to 7 p.m. Central. Our call-in number is 312-263-4752, and you can also add to the conversation by posting on our wall at facebook.com/radioislam1450, or you can tweet us at Radio Islam 1450. And we're talking this evening with Alex Tabarak of George Mason University. Welcome back, Alex.
Good to be here.
Okay, so I can boil it down maybe into just two main themes which would oppose this idea of universal, you know, right to relocate or move around. We discussed them in various ways already. One is a whole group of ideas or thoughts around economic an economic rationale, loss of jobs, increase in competition for those jobs, and potentially increase in unemployment simply because there's more supply than there was before of people. And the second one is cultural, which I don't want to necessarily completely lump with racial, because I think there are people who would reasonably defend themselves as not being racist, while at the same time as potentially valuing certain aspects of their own culture and feeling that might be at risk. Let's attack those two. Help us to understand how this does not, in fact, I mean, you mentioned how an individual moving, let's say, to the U.S. from, let's say, Bangladesh, for the sake of argument, will, see a multifold increase in their income. But what does that do to the unemployment level in this country, as an example of those two countries in particular?
Right, so I don't think there's any problem with unemployment at all. Mm-hmm. So plenty of jobs. So think about, for example, of the number of women who have moved into the labor force over the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. But a tremendous increase in the supply of labor and no increase on average in unemployment. And the same thing would be true with, more population. When people have children, right, a child is just a future immigrant. So when we have more children, a population goes up, we don't expect unemployment to necessarily go up at all. But because more people, there's more demand as well as more supply. So there's plenty of jobs.
And there's nothing to say that people who immigrate, who self-select with their, let's say, initiative, aren't going to be entrepreneurial enough to actually manufacture or make more jobs.
Absolutely. Many of our most famous immigrants, most famous entrepreneurs have been immigrants. Mm-hmm. People who are willing to take that risk to move are also the type of people who often, want to start firms and things of that right. nature. And more generally, there's a lot to be gained by cooperation. There's plenty of jobs here which people of lower skilled could do coming from the less developed world. There's also plenty of opportunity for high-skilled workers. We do some crazy things in the United States. We have a great educational system, and we invite people from all over the world to come and get an advanced education in the United States. And then after they get their degree, we say, oh, sorry, you got to go back home.
Unless a local firm has snapped one of them up in an internship or something. But anyway, look at it from the flip side also. I think you've got a reasonable argument on the other side, which is when someone leaves a country like this, there is an operative reduction in supply on that side. And so that tends to improve the economic circumstances of the workers in that area, if the emigration is large enough. Is that a reasonable position?
It's quite possible, and one of the things which makes our current system really a system of, frankly, global apartheid is that, the resources of the world are not equally distributed. So if someone has the misfortune of being born in a literal or figurative economic desert, mm-hmm. then there is very, very little that they can do to get a, decent standard of living, a standard of living that you and I would consider decent, simply out of the misfortune of where they were born, because of these walls which we put up and put into place, they are basically penalized and they are forever burdened with the fact of their birth, and there's very little ways of getting around that, unless we allow people to move. There's just no reason for there to be a lot of people in places which are economic deserts.
Yeah.
People should move out.
So now that brings me to the, and I agree with that point. So moving to the next point, which is the cultural protection, some notion of a loss of one's culture as a result of the arrival of quote unquote too many people of an alien country. This, you can see this in different ways. People have their own personal interpretation of what they think integration means. For example, when we're talking about large scale movements of people, what have you to say to people who, let's say, genuinely are not necessarily bigoted, unless you're redefining what that means, but may nonetheless have some sort of hankering for at least a constancy of culture that they feel is at risk as a result of this migration?
I think that's a perfectly natural feeling to have. Mm-hmm. I would say two things. First of all, on the sort of positive side, you know, I am mostly concerned about economic migration. Mm-hmm. And I have no problems with saying, you know, they wouldn't get, let's say, the right to vote for, you know, 10 years or something like that. I don't think that's a problem. You know, indeed, we can have voting rights different from moving rights. Okay. Now, but more importantly, really, on this cultural issue, and I would say this, and I put it in strong terms, but I think it's important, is that you don't have the right to determine what's in other people's heads. You know, you don't have the right to put a stop on culture or put a stop on change. I understand how people want things to be the same. They don't want things to change. They kind of like things the way they are. But, you know, nobody has that right to prevent other people from changing.
I want to add... Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I want to add to this point, because I feel very strongly about the point you're just making. I think there's a sort of mirage of what a culture is that is... It's not nearly as static as people... imagine it to be when it's their own culture. All cultures pretty much have many, many things about them that were anathema at one time or another.
Absolutely.
And it seems to me that one needs to be open to the fact that when we say, for example, the American way of life, that is a changing thing. And as a desirable thing, it's a changing thing. It may have things that you may not desire individually, or even large numbers of people may not desire at a given point in time, but it ultimately evolves if one, you know, unless you impose draconian measures to prevent it from doing so.
Absolutely. I mean, the only place which hasn't changed very much in the last 50 years is North Korea, and I don't think we want to live there.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, I mean, coming back to China, it's an intriguing point you made. So help me, because I mean, Chinese culture is quite different from, although the entrepreneurially they're very, very similar, I would say, to American, you know, the ideals of entrepreneurialism. But as far as other aspects of Chinese culture, it's quite unfamiliar, let's say, to what would be considered current American culture. So what prompted, you know, what event or events led to the open border, you know, situation, you know, turning into a more closed position, say, for the United States? So how did that come about?
So Chinese workers were very much in demand for the American West and the railroad. So there was an open border, not just to the Chinese, but to, you know, people all over the world. But as it happened, a lot of Chinese came. And, you know, so this is an interesting point that you make about American culture, because the Chinese built, you know, some of that American culture. They built the railroad. You know, they built a lot of the Pacific. And, you know, people today, it's interesting, they're, you know, some people are worried about the, you know, invasion of Mexicans or something like that. When actually, when you look at the United States, you know, most of it was Spanish, right?
Right.
you know, it's a huge, huge swath of it were purchased from Spain, you know, by Thomas Jefferson. And for much, much longer, they were Spanish-speaking than they were American-speaking.
Or English-speaking.
English-speaking, yeah. English-speaking is what I mean, yes.
Yeah. Yes. Although the Brits might have an argument with you about that.
Yes, that's right, yes.
So what event, what happened to change this openness towards the Chinese coming in?
Yeah, so, you know, it was a racist response, I think, is that, the railroad was basically finished, and we didn't quite need so many of these workers, and some people decided they didn't like them. And all of the things that we're hearing today, you know, about Mexicans, for example, all of those things were said about the Chinese at the time.
Yeah, you know, I now you say that, I recall reading, I have no idea where, but there were laws that would punish people, like, you know, for killing, obviously. But I remember exceptions, like not counting slaves and Chinamen.
That's exactly.
Is that, am I recalling that accurately?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know about that one in particular, but that in general, that is certainly true. And people said that the, you know, that they were bringing crime with them, and they were being, you know, different ways, and, you know, that they weren't, that they worked so hard. It was amusingly, again, just as with Mexicans today, it's kind of amusing that, on the one hand, they're said to be lazy and go on welfare, and on the other hand, they're said to be to work so hard that they're taking all the jobs.
For too little money. Yeah, just sort of wrapping it up, you know, there's, one of the things I found that attracted me, frankly, to coming to this country from the UK was the noticeable difference in terms of the celebration of diversity. Let's take the China example. You have enclaves in various cities in the country, San Francisco being very notable, New York another one, Chinatowns, where from a certain perspective, these are seen as things to be celebrated, that these exist in these communities. You know, is that simply a process of maturation that arises as a result of people, you know, settling in and I don't know, just integrating, yes, but nonetheless maintaining their cultural identity?
Yeah, you know, I think one thing that's interesting here is that many people who fear foreigners, they believe that, you know, American culture is in danger, and they believe that American culture, in effect, is kind of weak. Mm-hmm. And I actually think very much the opposite.
I do too. American, I think its strength is that it embraces, you know, new cultures coming in. It embraces
absolutely.
Quite readily.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it's interesting when you go around the rest of the world. What are people in the rest of the world worried about? They're worried about American culture taking over, right? So over here, we think that we're going to lose it, and the rest of the world
is worried that they will gain it. Yeah.
It's Coca-Cola and rock and roll and sexual liberation, all of these things which are associated with America, the idea of liberty, of free markets, all of these things are actually taking over the entire world. So
and
if
on,
you look
on
at
that
the world,
note,
you know, they're very strong.
On that note, I'm sorry to have to curtail the conversation. It's fascinating. But that's all we have time for, unfortunately. Stay with us after the break on Radio Islam. We're going to be switching gears. If you want to, please call in at 312-263-4752 or post on our Facebook page at Radio Islam, facebook.com/Radio Islam 1450.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes. And you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to. Nope. I'm sure you've got a perfectly good excuse. Kids, work. I get it. You're busy. So what better time than now? Let's begin. Raise one finger if you're a man. Ladies, none yet. Oh, count in your head if you're driving. Now, three more fingers for everyone over 60, two over 50, one over 40, one more if you're not physically active, another finger if anyone in your family has type 2 diabetes, another if you've got high blood pressure, if you're overweight, raise another finger, two if you're very overweight, and three if you're really overweight. You've just taken the world's first audio prediabetes test. And if you're holding up five or more fingers, visit doihaveprediabetes.org or talk to your doctor. There's no excuse, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
So, Jacqueline.
Yes, Mom?
I wanted to talk to you about something and... Oh, wait. Hold on. I just got a text.
Oh, wait, Mom. I just got a message. So many comments on my comment.
Hey, guys, check out my new video game.
Mom, what?
Huh?
Pew, pew.
What'd you say?
This weekend, unplug. Getting closer to nature can get you closer to your family. To find the forest nearest you, go to discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
It's 6:42 p.m. Time for Steve Plato and his son Dylan to do the dishes.
They talk about everything from the yuckiness of girls to the awesomeness of his soccer team. Sometimes they don't talk at all. Then, hey! The dreaded splash fight. It's dad o'clock, and it's the best time of the day. Because the smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
This is a rebroadcasted episode. Catch us on all social media at Radio Islam USA.
Welcome back. You're listening to Radio Islam at WCEV 1450 AM Chicago. We reach the world by streaming live at radioislam.com, where you can also review all of our prior shows. We're a live call-in talk show on the air every night from 6 to 7 p.m. Central. Our call-in number is 312-263-4752, and you can also add to the conversation by posting on our wall at facebook.com/radioislam1450 or tweeting us at radioislam1450. We were talking about migration being a basic human right as the first segment of the show this evening. For the second half of our program, we'll be presenting our Justice for All segment that we bring to you every month. The host for this segment is Adam Carroll, who is the New York and UN Program Director for Justice for All.
This is Adam Carroll from Justice for All, our regular segment on Radio Islam. This month, we're speaking with Menaz Afridi, Assistant Professor of Religion at Manhattan College in New York and Director of Holocaust, Genocide, and Interfaith Education Center. She's also the author of a book, Shoah Through Muslim Eyes. And Shoah, of course, is a word for the Jewish Holocaust. So this is the Holocaust Remembrance Week. At least a lot of people are marking the occasion. Sister Menaz, wanted to ask you, how long has this been an occasion for remembrance, this late April, early May period?
This has been a remembrance for a long time. It was set up as a remembrance in 1980s, and it changes every year, so sometimes it's in April, this year it's on May 5th specifically. And there's two different kinds of remembrances. It's Yom HaShoah, and then there's a Holocaust International Remembrance Day, which is on January 27th.
Mm-hmm. And so is the date chosen for any particular historical reason?
It is chosen for historical reason, and it's usually around the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, but it's also a UN, an international date that was set by the Holocaust Remembrance Day. So there's two different dates. One is a date that is set by Israel on the Jewish calendar, and one is by the international calendar.
Now, as a Muslim woman, when you started as director of the center, of the infamous Pam Geller greeted the news by saying 6 million dead Jews are weeping and screaming from their graves, and some of the New York politicians were equally unkind. This is quite, I guess it's seen as an unusual thing to have a Muslim in this role. What brought you to the role, and how has it been?
Well, what brought me to the role was, my specialty, which is Islam and then Holocaust. So, it was an amazing job description. I thought it would never happen, but I had already started to interview survivors and done work in 19th century Germany and the Holocaust. But also my passion was to study Islamic literature, and that's what my PhD is. And the controversy was not completely, shocking, because there's so much mistrust between Muslims and Jews, unfortunately, especially now. But I think that since I've been here, this is my fifth year, and the community has been amazing and very supportive. There has not been any kind of controversy over what I've done, because I think Jews and most people realize that, I'm not here to take away the memory of the Holocaust. I'm here to educate. I'm here to create awareness of Jews all over the world, especially in the Muslim community.
And at the same time, I'm sure there are questions raised based on this tension between Jews and Muslims, or Jews and Arabs, over the Israeli-Palestine conflict, of course, and the injustices that took place during the founding of the State of Israel and through today. So I'm sure that you're getting some pushback from Muslims, too. But first I wanted to ask you, denial of the Holocaust, how widespread that is that in the Muslim world?
Well, you know, in terms of education, we don't have much education of the Holocaust, and there are several reasons for that. But one of the things that I do work on is looking at Muslim rescuers during the Holocaust, and also the colonial history of the surrounding Arab countries at that time. And interestingly enough, it's narratives that I talk about, two different narratives coming from two different contexts, and then going all the way up to the State of Israel in 1948, and also discussing contemporary issues. So I think it's interesting, but I think looking at the Holocaust, looking at where people were placed at that time, brings education forth into the Muslim world, but also educates Jews about the colonial history that Muslims all over the world have undergone. And so if you look at places like North Africa, or even look at, you know, Eastern Europe, like Albania, if you look at Iran, you know, there were Muslims who rescued Jews because they were not part of the Vichy or the Nazi campaign. And that's a very misunderstood image that non-Muslims have about Muslims. And I think it's very important to kind of deconstruct the stereotypes that we have that are not historically factual.
It sounds like a great opportunity to reframe the narrative, and in fact reframe narrative as a conversation that engages various points of view. You mentioned doing the oral histories of survivors, and I grew up in New York City, so I remember people with the blue numbers on their arms, my neighbors and people I cared for. What was it like to do this oral history of Holocaust survivors?
It was actually very interesting for me. I was in Los Angeles when I did that, and I still work with survivors locally because our center also has a Bureau of Survivors. But I approached the Museum of Tolerance in Los Angeles, and they put me in touch with survivors who were willing and able to speak. And the response was amazing because they themselves had never spoken to a Muslim person or a woman, you know? So I think for them it was as interesting and intriguing as it was for me. And there were a lot of instances where we ended up educating each other from different generations, from different cultures and backgrounds, but really building a friendship and also clearing up misunderstandings that perhaps they had about Islam or who I was, or especially being a Muslim and whether I was oppressed. So it was a very, very engaging time for me. But, you know, just learning the horrors and the suffering that Jews had to go through was, for me, I mean, I had many, many sleepless nights just thinking about what human beings could do to one another.
And continue to do to each other. Certainly we see what's happening in Burma and what's happened in Armenia and Ukraine and the Central African Republic and Congo and just so many places, not to mention Syria.
Right.
Whether it's conflict or however you label it, persecution or genocide, it's mind-boggling. So you've engaged with this. Well, I think that after the station break, we'll continue. And I wanted to ask you about the recent conference as well as an upcoming conference that you're planning.
So, Justin, I was playing that video game Forest Brigade, and it was pretty cool. I was running down this, like, digital path, and I met this digital frog. He was all like... And then I went playing in this virtual stream where this water... It looked almost real. It was this whole electronic forest world. So what did you do?
Well, my parents took me to the forest. The real forest. Where I was running down this... Well, it was an actual path. Then I saw this real-life frog. It was all like... Ribbit, and I saw an owl too. Then I played in this amazing stream with water around my ankles, like wet water. Then me and my sister and my parents sat around a campfire and told cool stories all night long.
Oh, that's pretty cool too.
This weekend, unplug. Getting closer to nature
can get you closer to your family. To find the forest nearest you, go to discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Hey, America, we need to have a little talk. We've got more food than we know what to do with in this country, yet 17 million kids in America are struggling with hunger. Makes no sense. Luckily, the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks has volunteers gathering excess food and getting it to hungry kids. They're kind of like food angels. Hey, become a food angel yourself by supporting Feeding America and your local food bank at feedingamerica.org. We can't do it without your help. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. This is Adam Carroll from Justice for All with our special monthly report. This time we're speaking with Munaz Afridi, the director of the Holocaust, Genocide, and Interfaith Education Center at Manhattan College. And welcome back, Munaz.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We were talking about your efforts to create dialogue and to promote human rights education, culture of human rights and human value. I wanted to ask you, are there lessons that you feel are particularly applicable now? Obviously, Donald Trump is not Hitler. However, when you see around the world the rhetoric beginning to demonize or continuing to demonize immigrants, Muslims, or any other minority, it's got to put a little more concern into your colleagues at the center. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of thoughts on this, brother, because it's basically the work I do. I mean, for me, I think one of the thing, the primary things for me is education. And people say, well, you know, you teach the lessons of the Holocaust, I teach the lessons of other genocide. My students and I just covered Armenia, although right now Armenia is in trouble, under the Turks, which is disheartening. But one thing that I think is really important is to listen to the rhetoric of politicians, because what it tells you is how we have become so polarized in terms of thinking of religious identity and religious identity becoming racialized. So, I mean, one of the things that I talk about in my work and also in public and lectures and seminars is, you know, parallels, a lot of parallels pre-Holocaust Jewish history, which was, you know, full of anti-Semitism, and now looking at Islamophobia. There's a lot of parallels that we can make, and when you start to look at those things, you start to think about what it means to be other today. So, I mean, I think the rhetoric that we have from politicians, it hasn't really changed that much. But what has changed is the direction that people want to go into, and that is, you know, not being threatened by others. And basically, when we start to have prejudice, racialization, it's always a fear about others, that fear which is attached to myths. And that myth that is attached to some kind of idea that these people will come and take over, and they're threatening to that society. So there's a lot of levels to your question. But I think right now, students and young people are also responding to some things that are very positive. I mean, we see a lot of youth active in the Sanders campaign, which is a balanced campaign in terms of politics, in terms of immigration, in terms of looking at the notions of other. And, you know, the other thing is a lot of Muslims are voting for a Jewish candidate, and that's never talked about. I think there has to be more conversation about that, because it is about across borders, especially in the United States. And I feel very lucky being here, because I recently taught in Venice at the Jewish ghetto at its 500th anniversary. And Muslims are really very much outcast in Europe in a very severe way. And
I understand in Italy that there's very few mosques in most of the major cities, at least officially allowed mosques. So there's another level.
Yeah, there's a whole different level. So I think, you know, for me, I look at the experience, I learn from different places, look at the history and the context, And the thing is, you know, why do this work? People ask me all the time, you know, there's nothing, there's no change, there's still genocide going on all over. And my response is that if you can get 25, you know, 19 to 20-year-olds to do a whole day of awareness on Armenian genocide, they're going to have to think twice when they're faced with these questions when they're, you know, walking around in the United States or in Europe.
Right. Well, sometimes these questions of genocide become politicized or overly legalistic. The recent statement by the U.S. State Department that the persecution of the Rohingya Muslims is not genocide, well, you know, at the same time, it's extremely severe and protracted persecution. And so what are these labels? You know, do they sometimes hinder us rather than help us respond and prevent? As far as prevention, does your center get involved at all in prevention activities, genocide prevention?
No, unfortunately, we're not big enough. It's basically I'm the director and I have a student worker, and, you know, whatever we can do, we try to do. But the idea of prevention is, you know, it's very interesting because if you look at Bosnia or if you look at Armenia, and I'm not, you know, not necessarily the Holocaust or even the Holocaust, I mean, people knew that there was a genocide going on throughout the three. And there was very little done. And there was very little done because, like you said, there were geopolitical reasons. Or right now, we are still having an ongoing genocide in Darfur since 2003. Mm-hmm. And even though Bashir has been, the President Bashir has been accused of genocide by the ICC, we cannot do anything about him because he has to be in a country which recognizes that international tribunal of crime.
Right.
So,
I mean,
these things are, you know, the prevention is very important, but I think the prevention has to be from within. And we need it here in the United States, you know, where, you know, we can't have the rhetoric that some politicians have about Mexicans or Muslims or even Jews, right? I mean, this has to be something that we have to prevent here because we also have experienced genocide in this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, recently you organized a conference in Manhattan College. I was only able to attend for one day, but it was combining studies of anti-Semitism and studies of Islamophobia and with a discussion among those groups, and it was very interesting. I was wondering, you know, how you felt it went and was there an outcome? Will there be a publication?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I'm really happy to say is that, you know, there's always been a Jewish Christian group or Muslim Jewish group or a Christian Muslim group, but now we have a steady group of people that are doing Jewish Muslim Christian overlays. And what I think came out of that conference was sometimes you didn't really know who was representing whom, and I think that's the most important thing in terms of looking at. You know, cohorts are really interested in, say, for example, I'm really interested in Jewish history, or other people are really interested in Muslim history. I mean, there's an overlay and there's an overlap in terms of these issues. I think what we're going to do is continue our work, and this kind of work is going on all over. I'm actually going to Philadelphia in July to give the plenary about Muslims in America at the International Christian and Jewish Conference.
Mm-hmm.
And I work very closely with the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, where I went, you know, building a curriculum to teach, you know, to different diverse groups. Then the USC Shoah Foundation is also very interested in connecting with the Muslim community. So I think there's a lot of very important work being done. But again, as you know, media always focuses on the very negative aspects of what's going on. I mean, we work diligently at Manhattan College with students. We take them to mosques, where we have them work with Jewish teens and Catholic teens. There's a mosque that is housing a Chabad community in the Bronx. I'm very close to that mosque and its congregation. But people don't hear these stories. You know, they're just kind of lost in the whirlwind of politicians.
Mm-hmm. And then we're divided and conquered.
What? Yes.
So you have an event coming up on May 4th that you're participating in. For the New York listeners, I was wondering if you could briefly mention.
Yeah, it's at B'nai Yeshurun. I've been, of course, honored again to be invited to commemorate Yom HaShoah, which is really an honor for me as a Muslim And I just started, you know, I started getting these invitations last year from temples and different centers. So this year, I'm going to recognize the Muslim heroes and the protectors during the Holocaust so that we can kind of bridge our gaps, understand, and reach out to one another rather than building walls all the time. And, you know, there's a wonderful organization, I Am Your Protector, that is doing a whole campaign on Muslims who protect others during the Holocaust and even after, people who are doing heroic acts that are not being recognized. So we're going to focus on that. And I'm also going to share some of my, excerpts from my book about what it felt like to interview survivors so that the audience and the congruents have an idea that there has been, you know, I've always been kind of intimately linked with people that have been through this experience.
No, I'm sure these stories are fascinating. I know there was a Pakistani woman, there were Albanians, there were many, many people in Tunisia, and to hear their stories. And again, what's the website where people can go and get more details?
For the I Am Your Protector?
IamYourProtector.com?
.com, right.
Mm-hmm. And how about the website for your center?
My center is www.hgimanhattan.com.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much,
Mr.
Menard.
Yeah.
And good luck, and I hope we'll be in touch.
Okay. Thank you so much. My pleasure.
All right.
Okay.
Michael.
Bye.
You have been listening to Radio Islam, a call-in talk show from 6 to 7 p.m. 7 days a week on WCEV 1450 AM Chicago. To find out more about tonight's guests and their work, hop onto soundcloud.com/Radio Islam 1450, where you can also stream, download, and comment on our shows. The executive producer of Radio Islam is Abdul Malik Mujahid. I, Saima Sharif, have been your producer for today. And our engineer for this evening is Ramon Arevalos. Radio Islam is a Sound Vision Foundation production. The views expressed are the views of the host and the guests, not of the Sound Vision Foundation. Be sure to check out all of our past shows at RadioIslam.com and connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram under Radio Islam 1450. Your host for the evening has been Saladin Khan. Join us tomorrow evening for another great show on Radio Islam. Peace.
This is a rebroadcasted episode. Catch us on all social media at Radio Islam USA.